Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Kane and Rince podcast. It's volume 13, issue 606, and today we're going to talk about Metroid Prime 3, Corruption. And joining me, Leon Cox, in this issue, Brian Edwards.
Hello, hello.
And Leah Haydu.
Can the corrupted version of Metroid also not crawl, or is that just a thing?
Mm-hmm. So when Miss Metroid puts on her Metroid suit, which is what it's called, she's unable to crawl.
Okay. I was just wondering if, you know, it was a thing that, like, yeah, this is how you spot the difference. One of them can crawl.
It's like when Zelda tries to pull the Master Sword out but can't get it yet. It's like a whole thing. So
yeah, gotcha. Okay, understood.
If you realize if someone's tuning into us for the first time, they're just going to think we are the most clueless casual podcast of all time. Well, listen on and find out if that's the case. We're also supposed to be joined by our old friend Dan Clark, who's now a sort of, I mean, it probably doesn't make much difference from the listener point of view, but he's now been roped in as part of the regular contributor community. But he wasn't able to join us for this one because although we're happy to put our deeply loved contributors through the mill to get on this show, Dan unfortunately was suffering from what sounds like pretty severe motion sickness from trying to replay this game, having not played it for some time. He said he didn't experience this the first time around, but he was saying that the motion controls combined with the sort of the slight camera lag and all that stuff was making him feel extremely unpleasant. So yeah, while we'll make you do all-nighters to complete games that you're hating, making people actually physically ill is a step too far. So
One time when I played Duke Nukem Forever, but
yeah, you know, that's true.
Physically ill for a different reason there, Lee, I think.
Slightly.
So Metroid Prime 3 Corruption is the 8th mainline but 10th overall game in the Metroid series of sci-fi arcade action adventures, and the 3rd one in polygonal 3D, played from first person, concluding Retro Studios' Phazon saga, right? Of course, Metroid Prime 4 was announced many, many years ago and then re-announced 5 years ago, and wow. Still we wait. But as far as we know, as far as we have access to actually playing something that exists, this is the end of our 3D first-person Metroid run of shows. Brian, 2007. Mm-hmm. Are you clutching $60 and a nunchuck?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was definitely still on the Wii train. I was very excited for the Wii and had my Wii and was pretty much down for day one anything on that Wii when I first got it. So yeah, Metroid Prime 3 was a day one purchase for me, and I played through it in probably the better part of a couple weeks. And the funny thing was, and I find this more and more as time goes by, it's shocking how memory works as you get a little older, is when I replayed this game over the last 2 weeks for the show, I remembered some things, but mm-hmm. it was almost as good as just a complete, you know, fresh playthrough for the first time. I didn't remember where anything was, didn't really remember any of the plot points. The only thing I really remembered is that, and I think I said this to you, Leon, that this was the game that I remember feeling like I was an actual bounty hunter. Like, it felt different because you were kind of bopping back and forth to these little smaller locations and stuff. So other than that, like, replaying this over the last couple weeks, I was fairly shocked at how little I remembered of it. But I'm really glad I replayed it for the show to make myself fresh. And I finished it a few days ago, and I want to say I was something around 70% completion, and my game clock was off because it said it said 8 hours, but according to my the handy dandy Wii calendar, which tracks your app usage time, it was somewhere around 16. So I'm not sure what was the mishap there, but let's say somewhere safely in the 15 hour range to complete it. And then I've been back a couple times just to kind of do some mop up stuff and look for some missile upgrades and go back to that derelict spaceship to put all the energy cells in and do those things. So just kind of bopping around.
Maybe the game clock doesn't track cutscenes.
Yeah, maybe that's it. We'll see.
I don't think this isn't Metal Gear Solid. It doesn't have 6 hours of cutscenes, but maybe it's got a little bit more than
maybe it doesn't track time spent in the map. I did spend a lot of time in the
could
map,
be.
But we'll see.
I would say that was playing, but yeah, who knows? Quirky, Leah. What about yourself? Were you an early adopter of this one or not?
So I graduated with from grad school in 2007. And
congratulations.
Then thank you. And then I worked at a GameStop later in 2007 because that master's degree was in English literature. So I actually didn't
GameStop,
get
GameStop.
A Wii directly at launch because I couldn't. Like, they were so rare. And it took massive amounts of, you think it was bad to get PS5s, man, getting a Wii was rough.
Yeah.
But when I finally did get one, I had Metroid Prime 3 pretty close to when it launched. I have my original Wii still. It's been a trooper, man. Those things are indestructible. And I went back and looked at my saves from the original time that I played Metroid Prime 3. And it would have been, like, kind of early to mid-2008. So pretty close to when it actually came out. But I never actually finished it. I thought that I had, but I did not. So when I went back this time, I played through the whole game and did finish it as of yesterday. My game clock hit somewhere around the 12-hour range. I was following a walkthrough, but I was also being pretty meticulous along the way to do pickups and you know, additional energy packs and that kind of thing, because I'm not great at these kinds of games, and this one does not have an easy mode, so it you know, not unplayable by any stretch, but it was something that I kind of needed to pay attention to and buff myself out for as much as possible.
Right. Yeah, my history is very straightforward. It came out and I bought it and I completed it. And then years later, I bought the digital version release of the trilogy, which gives me the ability to go back to it on the Wii U. And it's pretty much exactly the same as it was on the original Wii. Because obviously, unlike the previous two games, which we've now covered and I've gone back to with the inserted and upgraded Wii controls, this already had them. So, yeah, as our Patreon, Cormoran Strike, posts, the main thing I remember about Prime 3 launching is that they put Super Metroid on the Wii Virtual Console to get some hype going, which I'd never played before. Also, it had some very cool trailers. Maybe it's the motion controls or possibly because it's the first game in the series to have voice acting, but I have a really soft spot for it. I think the motion controls are some of the best on the console, even now. It's a little more action orientated than the first two and less of a sprawling map, but I quite like that. Some great action, some incredible music, and incredible art direction. Yeah, I also remember there was some kind of promotional Wii channel. It wasn't a demo, but it was some sort of Metroid-related thing that I downloaded and interacted with a bit. But, yeah, memory fails me as to what it actually did, but it was just a kind of, a promotional item. Not sure if that was Michiel may have been at Nintendo Europe at this point, so he might have remembered that. But I also picked up Super Metroid. I probably mentioned this on the Super Metroid podcast, but because I'd never finished that up to this point, and that was when I first finished Super Metroid ahead of playing this. So I pretty much played Super and this back to back, having bounced off two Echoes as we previously discussed on that show. But this one was, I think it's fair to say it was an easier play than Metroid Prime 2 Echoes. But interestingly, looking at going on YouTube and looking at articles now, it seems to be that both this and Echoes are kind of equally divisive. And it might even be the case, and I'm sure there are exceptions, that this is one of those where if you love Echoes, you might not like Corruption so much and vice versa, because there's quite a lot of stuff, I think, in Corruption that's almost as a response to some of the things in Echoes that not everyone was so keen on. Is that fair?
I had to tab out of the Metroid Prime 2 show for different reasons, but I also kind of bounced off of 2 not right at the beginning, but it was not something that I enjoyed as much. And I have some problems with 3, but I think that I prefer it probably to 2. This is a game that, like, if the giant things that I don't like were fixed, I would probably really, really like this game.
Okay. Well, so, hold on to those thoughts, yes. Naturally. So Retro Studios developed this again, the third in the series. I think there was some help from internal Nintendo studios. That was probably the case on the prior games as well. But Retro Studios is the marquee. Nintendo obviously published it. Pre-production started in October 2004, still in GameCube times, and there were around 70 people on the team. It was first shown to the public at the E3 show in 2005 with a short pre-rendered trailer, and it was later announced during Nintendo's press conference at E3 2006. Nintendo revealed in May that Corruption would be released as a launch game for the Wii, but a few months later it was delayed until 2007. Mark Pacini returned as the director from the previous game. The art director returned, Todd Keller, and I think most of the team are the same as Metroid Prime 2 Echoes, with the exception of some designers, which may be or may not be relevant. The game was released on the Wii in America first, August 27th, 2007. 2 months later, because that's how things worked. I mean, this is, 17 years ago now, or there and thereabouts. It was a two-month delay. Hardly seemed like anything to us at that point, because we used to have to deal with year-long delays or more. So 26th of October in Europe wasn't a problem. And Australia got it another few days or so later, early in November. And oddly, the game didn't arrive in Japan until March 2008. The game had a few minor changes made to it for the Japanese release.
It does make you wonder, like, you look at this release calendar for Metroid Prime 3, and then you hear you just kind of hear, you know, through the grapevine that, you know, that Nintendo themselves just doesn't view Metroid as this big thing, right? You know what I mean? That, like, we as Americans or Westerners, you know, it's a big part of our childhoods, and, you know, whether it was a console market, or I know that, like, even, like, Super Metroid, widely regarded one of the better games of all time, but then you see it's always kind of Japan last, and it doesn't seem like that enthusiasm is necessarily shared in Japan for Metroid. Now, I don't have sales figures, obviously, but it does kind of lead to, you see these dates and these things kind of back up, like, yeah, maybe it does feel like the Japan-centered Nintendo versus your Nintendo of Europe, Nintendo of America, doesn't see Metroid as this marquee thing in the way that we all view it as, kind of like a, you know, like a cornerstone in our gaming history. It's just interesting to, and again, a lot of it's just, you know, supposing, you know, taking guesswork on things we don't actually know, but it's just, it makes you wonder if those rumors are true.
I think also, as well as that, there was the relatively late adoption of the whole idea of first-person games in Japan. They were less popular than they were in the West for a long, long time. There's that famous anecdotal story about when Elite, the space trading simulator, was converted to the NES, and when they demoed it in Japan, there was confusion about not being able to see any kind of ship or avatar on screen because you were looking out of your cockpit window into space, that kind of thing. And maybe some of that stuff, you always have to take it with a pinch of salt, because you wonder if there's any kind of cultural bias going on, or you know, even snobbery or whatever. But I think it is true that it took a while. I seem to remember that games like GoldenEye and Perfect Dark, you know, they basically had to be remarketed and kind of pushed in a different way to catch on in Japan. I think things are quite different now, although I think overall there's probably still a preference towards character action-based stuff rather than first-person stuff. But I think that needle has moved. But back in 2007, I think maybe first-person Metroid was less of a draw maybe than, I mean, interestingly, we'll talk about it later this year, but the next one they made, they went back to sort of 2D, didn't they? Yeah, with a Japanese studio making it. Was it a success? Join us later this year to find out. Buscalili from the forum says, I played this game to completion as an excited Wii owner. I was 17. The Wii was my only home console. It was a first-person sci-fi adventure, and it had good music and played nicely. I'm sure I convinced myself it was just as good as the Halo games my friends were playing. Since then, I don't think I've ever thought about it again. As every other Metroid has tempted me around multiple times, including this game's two predecessors, I'm intrigued what I would find if I ever returned. Will I be pleasantly surprised, or will it turn out there's a reason I don't remember anything? That echoes a little bit what you were saying, Brian. The Metroid Prime Trilogy release, which was all three games on the disc for the Wii, arrived in America August 2009 and September 2009 in Europe. And then it was digitally re-released on the Wii U eShop in both regions January 2015. And if you bought it, well done. You've still got it, if you've still got your Wii U. Reviews were really positive. Metacritic has a 90 score out of 100 from 62 reviews. Looking at users on Mobi Games, we've got 8.7 out of 10 from 24,000 folks. On Nintendo Life, we've got 8.5 out of 10 from 800-odd folks. And on Metacritic, it's got 8.7 again out of 10 from 461 folks. So, pretty good. 8-point high. And sales, again, were around 1.3 million or more, a little bit more. Worldwide, that's as of March 2008, but we can assume that it sold most of its copies by then. I don't have sales figures for the trilogy, either physically or digitally. Let's say make up. It sold in total 1.5 million copies.
Considering the absolutely wild numbers that you hear out of things like Mario Kart 8, that almost doesn't seem like much for Nintendo. Maybe that's why they're not as into it. Yeah.
So this game obviously continues this this trilogy of games, which is set, if I recall, actually very early in Samus's career. And probably one of the most controversial aspects of this game and the next one, Other M, were the fact that they started perhaps heading down the route of having, you know, more in the way of presentation of story, cutscenes, voices. Interestingly, they ended up really in this game doing what they would go on to do with Link in Breath of the Wild, which is have the rest of the cast talking, but have remain your avatar as a silent protagonist, which makes somehow to me makes more sense with Link because he's this kind of slightly mystical fantasy figure who spans time and generations, whereas Samus is portrayed in this as being a soldier, well, a hired soldier, effectively. So it doesn't make so much sense that she's mute.
Maybe she just can't talk through the helmet.
She's got a breather in her mouth. Yeah, it could be. I'm sure you hear a sort of ooh and ah sometimes, do you? Or at least wince.
So yeah, just the getting hit sounds.
Yeah, the death scream is there for sure.
Oh, yes, there is also that, sure.
So the Galactic Federation's base Sector Zero is under attack by space pirates, capital S, capital P. Samus must boot up the generator to restore the defense systems, but at the end of her path, someone awful is waiting for her. Tucker Carlson. No. The war initiated by Dark Samus and the space pirates rages across many planets as they attempt to corrupt each other with Phazon seeds. Players use the Wii remote and nunchuck to explore alien landscapes, hunt for weapons and information, and destroy the seeds. Saving the planets from corruption isn't enough, though. Eventually, players must take down Samus's mortal enemy, Dark Samus.
Threatening, yes.
So I suppose, really, a lot of the story of this game, there is a certain amount of exposition and dialogue, or at least text dialogue, in the previous game. But going back to this, it strikes you that, so this came out a little ahead of or around the time of Halo 3, and it does feel to me like they perhaps wanted to get on board that train a little bit, which sits at odds with what I think many existing Metroid fans wanted from the vibe of their game. I don't know if you feel differently to that, Brian.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it kind of both works and also is antithetical to what Metroid the game ends up being. But I did like at the beginning, you know, it felt starting a Metroid game normally is normally, you know, small cutscene, alien world, plop, where do I go? Mm. But this game definitely started with a more, what I would say, a modern traditional opening. You know, there's yeah. long hallways with NPCs that talk to you, and then there's an exposition room, basically, and then things happen, yeah. and then you go out on your grand adventure after everything kind of breaks down. I did like that kind of room with the bounty hunters, like that initial reveal of, like, you know, putting Samus in the role of just another one of the tools at the Federation's disposal, right? Mm. Like, because before, yeah. like in every other game, Samus has just kind of been, like, as far as we know, the only bounty hunter in the galaxy or whatever. But to see her kind of, like, amidst her peers and, like, kind of seeing these other characters with their powers and their, you know, in some cases their big, you know, designs or mysterious, like, shape-shifting ways and stuff was a cool way to kind of give that foreshadowing of the bosses mm-hmm. you're going to fight later. I that did work for me. Now, as far as the actual story of what happens in the game and why the seeds and the space players are doing that, I just finished this game like 4 days ago, and I couldn't tell you a thing about any of that. Like, that just went woof, like right over the head, whatever. But I did yeah. know that there was a Dark Samus, and there was a bunch of other bounty yeah. hunters who were corrupted, and boy, I sure wanted to shoot them all in the face.
Yeah, when you get that initial scene, it's like, oh, hey, look, these are the bosses I'm going to have to fight later. Mm-hmm. It's you know, and they are presented as being your comrades in that moment, the ones who are working with you. And you even get a little bit of them actually doing the work with you. But yeah, the whole time, even before, you know, I actually knew, okay, well, these are going to be bosses, I just kind of assumed just because of the way that they were presented. And that's something new for a Metroid game, as far as I know, mm-hmm. because, you know, you've never mm-hmm. really had this group of people that you've known in any capacity before you go fighting monsters, you know? It's just not something that you typically would see. So I thought that was kind of a neat setup for Samus to have these connections that just then get basically exploded. The other thing I liked, which is, I guess it's tangentially a story thing, I like that we don't get the like ability loss in the beginning of this one.
Yeah.
Sure. I kept yeah. waiting for that to happen because I couldn't remember if it did. And you don't start out with like a bunch of powers, but you don't have to like go collect the morph ball again. You don't have to get your double jump back. You know, you have some of the skills that you would maybe expect to have, and then you're just kind of enhancing what you have as you go, rather than, oh, look, here's all of these cool things that you can do. Just kidding. Now you have to go get them all back because that's what you do in a Metroid game. So, yeah, that was something I did enjoy about the setup.
Yeah. Corruption, according to Wikipedia, is the first Metroid game to feature a significant amount of voice acting compared to the previous games in the series, which Samus acted alone and always came across as a lone wolf. The producers decided to include voices to create a stronger connection between players and the characters. Characters' voices were performed by Timothy Patrick Miller, Lainey Fraser, Christopher Sabat, Edwin Neal, Claire Hamilton, Brian Jepson, Gray Haddock, Clayton Gyas, and Ken Webster. None of which I'm... And Troy Baker.
Yeah. I looked it up because he's in the credit. He's like credited first, because I think they just did it in alphabetical order, but he's credited first. And he just does like some random soldier voices. He doesn't do any of the main characters. But
early in his
funny.
Career, I guess. Relatively.
Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was before fedoras with feathers in them and NFTs.
He gives... With his performances, he takes away with his off-field activities.
Yep, so it is.
In Metroid Prime 1 and 2, said Mark Pacini, the director, there was a lot of reading. We're not really going overboard with story in Prime 3.
Yeah, they really into that whole Halo thing. Like, we don't need people to read. Let's just... Yeah. I'm kidding. I also like Halo.
Yeah. It is interesting that the amount of, like, lore scanning stuff was definitely decreased, right? Especially, we played Metroid, I think we all played Metroid Prime 2 fairly recently.
So,
I definitely was coming off of that, you know, scanner's grip of the Wiimote, you know, and just like I needed to scan everything. And this, these, the lore areas are kind of telegraphed to you. They have those really kind of neat, textured, the walls almost look like they're flaming, right? So like these panels will go away and there'll be like a flaming wall with a bunch of characters you don't understand on it, and you'll scan that, it'll give you some lore, and you can go in and engage with it if you decide you want to. But it felt like there was less of a reason to scan every room for everything again, like there might have been in the previous two entries. That was my experience, anyway.
I think the story was just more upfront, really, because they were doing all this voice acting and because they're telling you what it is that you're going to do. There's not as much that you need to just kind of figure out for yourself, like maybe there was in Prime 1 and 2.
Hmm. Visually, so the developer and artists, of course, had a little bit more room to play with. This being, at the time, the first game on the mildly more powerful Wii. It had a bit more RAM, you know. Famously, it wasn't, you know, an entire...
Two GameCubes taped together, yes.
Yeah, right. The old gag, yeah. So there's some truth to that. Certainly similar tech and not wildly more powerful, but just enough for them to perhaps play a little bit more with textures and design and... also some effects and things like that. I think probably from my point of view, the struggle they had was this being the third game in the trilogy, basically on a similar generation of machine, was actually kind of, obviously they'd gone to this darker place with the second game without just simply going back to the classic elemental biomes of the first game, which sure most people seem to love. I certainly love. I'm very happy in a classic fire ice jungle situation because they do appeal and they make a lot of sense, and they automatically give you a visual distinction between the areas and stuff. Here they're having to do multiple planets and give them each their own personality, but it does allow them to revisit the idea of the different elements and the classic biomes and things like that. But also they had to imbue it with this slightly more, yeah, I don't know. Well, I'm not sure what the word I'm looking for is, but that sense of areas being, rather than it all being on the same planet, they're alien from one another because sure. they're in different planets.
So this kind of ties into the story a little bit, but I liked how visually the planets seemed lived in. So a lot of Metroid games prior to this, not all, but I would say a significant amount, it's more about going into kind of the wilderness or the environments that the native creatures have taken up residence in. You're not usually going into things that are more like cities or just factories or anything like that. And here it's more centered around, like, what I'm thinking of specifically is the Elysia, the kind of sky planet that's all built for other creatures. Like, it's not just something that existed and other creatures have made it their home. You know, there is more building material here than you see much of in Metroid games leading up to this point. And I thought that was a really neat little twist, kind of. It's newer, I think, to me than I had seen in those other Metroid games.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that Elysia is it's kind of the standout for that. You know, really, like, I got immediate Cloud City above Bespin, yeah, Star Wars vibes from that. And and you step out, and if you go into the map, now I was thinking about this too, because I never would have thought about this back then, but if you go into the map, you can recognize these rooms are basically just really narrow hallways you go through.
Sure.
But when you're but when you're actually there, like on the platform looking out,
yeah.
and there's those like guide rails that you kind of do those little obstacle course, like, you know, glides down and everything else, like it looks vast. Like the sense of scale that they're able to create there. And it really feels like when you got to go from one end of the Cloud City to the other, that you are like going on a trek, you know, and it feels very big. And like you said, it feels very mechanical, built for some other purpose, as opposed to you're kind of entering in this alien world that just happens to have color coded doors. You know what I mean? Like this is
you literally have shuttles and trains and that kind of thing, which you didn't have before.
Yeah, that was really, I thought that was really neat. And I think that, like, the way I broke this up, and at least the note that I took was, is like, Brio was kind of your, like, prototypical Metroid game area, right? Mm-hmm. It had lava area, ice area, green area, you know, it has, like, your traditional biomes. But then anytime you left Brio to go anywhere else, it was kind of like, they all felt like their own weird little experiments, some successful, some not. I thought the is it Valhalla, is that the name of the ship? You go to with the energy cells that you can open up the different doors. You have to go there at one point to get something for a core. I can't remember, but it's the derelict spaceship. But there's a bunch of rooms in there that you don't ever have to go into, but it almost feels like a little survival horror-y in like a sense. It felt like very Dead Space-y in a way, like like everything's kind of real dark, broken down. You're putting keys to open up doors, and everyone you open up, there's flooded with Metroids and other things. And then you would leave that area, and you'd go back to Alesia, which is like a whole different environment, different feel. And I did like by having you physically get in a ship and fly from one place to another, it felt like they were given a little bit more leeway to just make things like stark contrast from place to place without necessarily having to explain it, because you are literally going from place to place. It was kind of a neat choice, I think.
And all the sky rails and stuff, surely an influence on the 2013 BioShock Infinite.
Yes.
Anything else about the visuals? One thing that I think they did change, and I think was a change for the better, even though it doesn't really... getting ahead of myself, but given that listeners probably will have listened to us talk about Metroid Prime 1 and 2 experiences already, although they perhaps still didn't give the enemy... response to being shot, you know, any more kind of sense of animation or whatever. At least when they when things die now, they burn away rather than just fading to nothing.
You like to watch them suffer a little bit? Is that where we're going with this?
Well, it gives a sense of the carnage I've been wreaking. Yeah, it just feels like your weapons actually have some effect, because I think if there was one thing that I would have always wanted to change about this trilogy of games is that the shooting felt a little bit more kind of impactful. And I suppose even though it's after the event, that just gives it a little more of a sense of that you're actually doing some damage. Yeah, if I sound sick, then I'm sorry.
there's also, and, you know, tying into the gameplay, there's a lot of enemies where you have to do something to them before they will be vulnerable. So you got to tear off their armor, take their shield away, or, you know, just shoot their armor off so that you can break it or whatever. And yeah, you know, I think the visual cues for that are pretty good.
Anything else either of you wants to say on that? Yeah.
The only thing I had left to say, and I'm not sure if this is more of a poor expectation of me, but like after just having recently played Metroid Prime 2, I was excited to jump back into Corruption to Prime 3 to see like what... Like, I was expecting like a generational leap in visuals, right? Like that's what I was in my head. I'm like, oh, it's going to look so much nicer. It's going to be that. And it felt very similar. Like, the design, even like the character animations and things like that. Like there was detail around it that made it clear that it was on a new console with a little bit more power, more things, more scale, but it didn't feel like some giant step forward either. So the visual language of these three games is really, it's kind of nice actually, because there's a continuity there. You can tell that these were games with a vision made by the same developer, and they made choices and they stuck to them, which is cool. But like, I was kind of expected, having just come off of 2, to be wowed by a couple things, and that wow never really happened. It was more impressive, but not, it wasn't that leap you kind of expect from generation to generation. Yeah. So
I don't think that this would account for all of that, but were you playing the trilogy versions of both of those?
So yeah, that's another reason I was thinking that that Metroid Prime 2 probably had a little extra polish on it for the
not a lot. I don't think it would be
the whole thing, but possibly a little bit of the difference made up in there.
They did a little bit of conversion work and remedial work on it, but it was mainly to tweak the camera and stuff for the second game. I think we talked about it to make some of the problematic bosses slightly less irritating, and obviously they brought in the 16:9, which wasn't in the original GameCube releases, if I recall correctly. But yeah, as I say, you know, double the, even though the Wii wasn't wildly more powerful than the GameCube, it did have more RAM, which enabled, and also more storage space on the disc, which is relevant a lot of times. Although in this case, it does actually mean that you perhaps got some slightly longer loading pauses.
Yeah. Oh yes, gosh,
games.
Those doors. I started out the game thinking, hey, the doors actually are all right at hiding those load times. And by the end, I was like, oh my God, please open the door. Yeah. The Metroids are trying to eat me.
Yeah, you're going through the same door for the fourth time in a row, just doing that like circle with the Wii stick, the nunchuck stick, to be like, open up, come on, let's go.
Yeah, and I suppose we may as well mention it here, just because if there's one thing that the Metroid Prime 1 remaster did really elevate compared to the original experience, it would be the visuals. I think most people are in agreement that they did a fantastic job on Switch with Metroid Prime 1. So that shadow dropped about a year ago now, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And here we are. Do we think, this is pure speculation corner, do we think 2 and 3 are still likely to happen, possible to happen, or is that it? We're just going to get 1 and done.
I have heard some things from other podcasts and other kind of news sources that suggest that it is very possible. But as we kind of know, Nintendo is not afraid to hold on to things forever if they need to.
Yep.
The Advance Wars reboots,
right?
And the remakes or the remasters of Twilight Princess and Wind Waker I believe they exist. I believe that I'm going to get that Wind Waker one day. I say that to say that I think that they probably have at least a start on those, even if they're not coming out immediately. Because I mean, there's going to be, whenever they do announce whatever the Switch's successor is, there's still going to be a period of time in between there where they're developing things for the new console but haven't actually put that out yet. So you've still got, you know, an active console in the current Switch, and they're going to need stuff for that, and they're probably not going to want to put all of their development resources into the old console with the new one coming. So maybe that's something that happens there, is my opinion on that.
It feels like a very Nintendo thing, that if the new hardware isn't ready for the next holiday season, that you could see something like the Wind Waker and Twilight Princess or Metroid Prime 2 and 3, you know, and each, you know, coming out for these two. And I think you're right. It's just, there's no way to know with them. Like, they had supposedly had that Metroid Prime remake done for years before they released it. Yeah. So
that's what I'm saying. I mean, they could have 2 and 3 sitting on the shelf already, but we don't know.
it will be interesting to see how all that plays out, for sure.
I'd love to see them.
Now, Leon, now that we are recording and have recorded the show, the remakes will be announced within, 4 or 5 days, just like the Metroid Prime remaster.
There's supposed to be a Nintendo Direct happening soon, so I don't know.
I think we said that with 2 and it didn't work, so let's try again. Yeah. Audio-wise, so the soundtrack was composed by, again, returning Kenji Yamamoto, Minako Hamano, and Masaru Tajima. The game takes advantage of the increased RAM and disk storage space compared to the GameCube, allowing for higher quality audio samples and stronger overall audio quality. I've always felt personally that although I think both 2 and 3 in this series sound great, they both just live in the shadow of Metroid Prime 1 for me in terms of audio, from the theme, the title screen, to the select screen, to the some of those area themes in that original game. I think they set such a high bar, and they were so impactful to me that they never quite landed anything as strong. But that is completely subjective. Are there themes and things in here, Brian, that moved you in any way?
I'm going to sound like a broken record this recording, but it's Alesia, really, is the area where I found most of my joy in this game, from not just gameplay, but also like things like this, like the musical, the themes in Alesia I thought were beautiful. I re-listened to the soundtrack again today, and I would say that that's maybe the only tune that I think is like a... memorable is probably a harsh word, but at least one that sticks, you know, that's like a one that I'd like to revisit from time to time. But yeah, I in general agree with you completely. It's they're standing on the shoulders of that stuff from the first Prime game that is like, so the battle theme, right, for like some of the combat encounters being very similar. Like, it feels like, oh, we're hearing the same thing again, but there's a reason they're reusing it. It's because it was great to begin with, you know, and it has a lot of character and builds tension in the appropriate ways. And like I think I said on the Prime 2 show, I think the achievement in sound in this game is in the design of the effects, your various whooshes and pops and, you know, laser sounds, and that that feeling when you charge up the corruption beam and let that Gatling go, like that noise. Oh man. Yeah. Bottle that. Let me buy it. I love that stuff. It matches the visuals too. And I think I've said this on all 3 Prime shows, so why stop now? That moment when you release a charge beam and the visuals, like, it kind of like sucks in the environment from the sides and like creates that like fisheye effect as it goes down a hallway, man. I mean, that's all of those things working in tandem again. I think this is probably maybe the best example of that, because I think they already spoke to it a little bit with like the more RAM and the more space for sound effect. It felt like everything sound wise was very polished. Everything had its own unique sound, noise, everything else.
Totally agree. I did have one weird experience with the music in this game, and it was towards the end. And I don't know whether it was my console or whether it was my copy of the game or what exactly it was, but the music started kind of glitching out a little bit, and I don't think that it was an intentional thing. Like, I'm pretty sure that it was just there was something wrong, but it didn't extend to the gameplay. Like, the game was playing fine, but the music was just like, it sounded like a record was skipping or something like that. So that was kind of weird. But overall, I agree that it was a nicely polished thing, but didn't necessarily stick with me the way that that the Metroid Prime 1 soundtrack really did.
Yeah, similar. And yes, absolutely. No, I'm not down on the overall soundscape at all. It's definitely consistent thematically and strong and all that stuff. And yeah, I love the sound effects, effects design and all that stuff as well. It's all about the fact that it's just sometimes something leaves such a mark, you know what I mean? Were you playing it off a disc, Leah?
I was, yes.
Yeah,
on the original hardware.
Maybe it's old school disc skipping.
I mean, maybe. Like I said, I thought if that had been it would have affected like the visuals or the gameplay or something, but it didn't. It was just the music. It was very strange.
Huh. I don't think it's Redbook, but maybe it is. I don't know. David Tibble from our Patreon says, Metroid Prime 3 has a reputation of being overly streamlined to get the, quote, casual Wii market and the burgeoning audience for console first-person shooters into the franchise. I agree with that premise, and at the same time, that was exactly what was needed to get someone like the adolescent me into Metroid. Prime 3 was my first Metroid game, and its more condensed but still exploratory environments allowed me to get my first taste of Metroidvanias and led to me being the fan of the genre I am today. So it was a gateway drug in some cases. Yes, it's so often it so often depends on the order in which you play these things. It makes me think of the, you know, what's your favorite Doctor Who or your favorite Muppet movie or whatever, like the favorite Zelda. The first one you play is going to be so informative that changes from that, can be off-putting forevermore to some extent. And I guess that's sort of, in a minor way, what I'm saying about Metroid Prime 1 compared to its sequels. But Metroid Prime 3, obviously we're about to get into the gameplay, but I think it is fair to say it's the game of the trilogy that has the least friction in terms of getting through it and completing. It's probably got the most health upgrades on the critical path and all that kind of thing. Perhaps got the least complex maps in some ways and the least complex weapon systems. And you can understand why people who have already played the first two games might balk at that if they got a huge amount of satisfaction. And in the end, these conversations that we have about these games, particularly games that require you to do a lot of navigation and finding your way through, we so often end up talking about how the game manages that. We've talked in the previous Metroid games about the finding the sweet spot between guiding the player and leading the player by the nose. And I suppose it just always comes down to whether it's just the right amount for any individual player or not. And it's not even like that will be consistent for ourselves, because sometimes we might play one of these games where we want to be, we've got that urge to be kind of thrown in and feel a bit lost and intimidated and all that stuff, and then other times you just want to kind of have the fun parts without the difficult parts.
I was shocked playing this game back again how many energy tanks were just on the critical path. My relationship with energy tanks in Metroid games is, oh my God, look at this shiny coin I just found. It's mine. Nobody touch it. Nobody look at me. Like this rare, I can't believe I stumbled across this, even though I was probably I was probably elegantly led to it, you know, via game design. But then to see them kind of all right on, not all of them, but a lot of them right in the critical path was wild to me. But I have a theory about that, and bear with me for a second. It kind of is going to go into something that I've heard Leah talk about before, is that I wonder how much of that is because the fact that this game was designed for the Wii. The Wii is a system, this is not a game that you can physically sit back and relax and play, because... Mm-hmm. You have to have your Wiimote pointed at the screen, and you have to be like kind of physically involved, right? And more so than just with dual analog sticks. So I found that this game was broken up into some really convenient chunks that every single time I sat down to play it, I felt like I was achieving an objective, finding an energy tank, finding a missile upgrade, fighting a boss, and then it would be like a natural breakpoint. And then it'd be the same thing again. Boom, 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 boom. It felt sectioned and chunked off very specifically in a way that I wonder is, and this is just me throwing it out there, was it to do with the fact that they were worried, like, how long could people be sitting in front of the TV and playing this game in one sitting? Because the most I played this game in a day, like leading up to this recording, I think I played like 4 or 5 hours in a day over the course of like 2 sessions. And by the end, I was done playing the Wii. Like, I was good. I needed a break for a minute, you know? I know, Leah, you've talked about this too, Leah. Yeah.
I have, yeah. And this is not something that is unusual for the Wii or for Nintendo in general, at least in recent years. Their consoles are not typically designed for these huge long gameplay sessions. And that's not to say that those games don't exist on the consoles, because they absolutely do. But their focus seems to be more on things that you can sit down for 20 minutes or half an hour and you make some progress, or you can play something with your friends for 20 minutes or half an hour and get something cool out of that. And I think that their first party titles are better when they are longer games at kind of incorporating that kind of gameplay loop. So like Brian was saying, I played a bunch yesterday, just, you know, kind of in, I found myself in the run up and I was like, okay, yeah, let's push through. I'm going to finish this. And I think the message that I sent to our chat in Slack was something like, my weak little baby wrists are suffering now. Because, you know, I have my Wii is still hooked up, but I don't always have the sensor bar set out, you know, because if I'm playing something, then it's probably for this podcast. But I do have it hooked up. And so, you know, I had everything set up, but the way I was sitting, or the way, like, where I usually sit, if I'm playing a video game on my television, it doesn't really lend itself to being pointed directly at the TV. So like I had to kind of be sitting straight up and be in a specific, like have my arm positioned a certain way so that my movements were being picked up. And it's not, the game is not super strict about where you are aiming, and that kind of, most of the time. Now, I found there to be some pretty notable exceptions to that, mostly the boss fights, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But I think that the weakest part of this game, for me at least, and I think this is a subjective thing, but I did not like the controls. I really wish I could have played this with a classic controller or with a GameCube controller or whatever. I wish that there were options for the control scheme in this so that I did not have to make my weak little baby wrists suffer.
I'm really conflicted on this now, because I was always an advocate for I really enjoyed playing this the first time around with the remote and nunchuck. And I was always somebody who, I would get a little frustrated at people who were kind of say, oh, you know, I'd love to play Mario Galaxy, but I can't be bothered with the stuff. Mm-hmm. And like, increasingly I do get it, especially as it does now feel like something of a period that happened 20 years ago, nearly, where this was an interesting experiment. And I think there was some good things about it. And when they first put these controls back into Metroid Primes 1 and 2, and that's the way I chose to play them, replay them for this show, I'm broadly positive. But there are, you know, I can admit there are downsides, and it is a different experience. It's a more demanding experience. I suppose it's not a million miles away from the way people talk about virtual reality and the reasons that still continues to be a thing. Increasingly, like, it's around, and it stays more than it did before VR. But every time I speak to anyone who even owns one or more VR setups, they always say, like, oh, I haven't had that thing on for ages. You know, like, there's always a period where they're like, I just can't be bothered with the...
looking at an Oculus Quest 2 sitting very close to me that has not been plugged in quite a while. So I get that, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously that's another level, but it's not dissimilar in the sense that it's out of the kind of the very I'm hesitant to say lazy, because it's not, you know, gaming compared to a lot of pastimes is not lazy. It's way more kind of intensive and interactive.
It's just a different experience,
I think. Yeah, that's it. But it is a bit more demanding in some ways to constantly make sure that your baby wrists are pointed in the right direction or whatever. But on the flip side, I do think that there was some immersion gain by having to input codes and move stuff around and aim at things on the screen. And so, yeah, it's very much a double-edged sword. I think ideally, I suppose, as with the Metroid Prime remaster on the Switch, you have the choice, I believe. You can use the Joy-Cons, can't you, on the Switch version to play in a style similar to the Wii, or you can just play it with your classic controller. And again, yeah, isn't that the ideal? But I suppose, again, this is tangential, but Darren and I were talking the other day about it's been in the gaming conversation recently about fewer big formats, with rumors, probably only rumors, of Microsoft ditching their own consoles to make games for other people's. It sounds like maybe what's going to happen at this point of recording on the 10th of February 2024 is that they are going to go more multi-format, but they're going to maintain their own platform. But we were talking about Nintendo's having their own platform, and how actually, like, we'd be happy to play Zelda and Mario and whatever else on whatever system and have fewer boxes to buy and things like that. But the whole thing about Nintendo is that they've always innovated with hardware, and it always influences their games and the development of those games, whether it be dual screen stuff on the DS or 3D stuff on the 3DS or motion control stuff on the Wii, even the microphone on the original Famicom handset in Japan. Like, they've always thought about this stuff. And if they were only making games for other people's platforms, that would be taken out of their hands. And I think that would be a shame. So, yeah.
Fidelity sensor coming back on the Wii to, or on the Switch,
it
too.
It could happen.
This is probably the appropriate time to talk about it. It's just, I agree with literally everything you just said, but I do feel that for as much immersion building as those motion controls were, they were also unreliable enough to make me frustrated on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And I specifically mean, there's only a couple circumstances of this. Like, you know, the turning and the pulling and pushing of the Wiimote, like that, sometimes that would be a little janky. Okay, I can put up with that. The one that I'm really struggling to forgive, that's such a harsh term. How dare these devs? No, the one that I struggle to get past is the using of the nunchuck to rip shields off. Is that I just don't think that nunchuck, whatever sensors, gyros, whatever they use, I don't know the technical wizardry. The fact that it can sense motion from that thing is already amazing to me. But when there's a couple boss fights where you have to rip off shield panels and the timing windows are the last phase. Yeah, so I'm yanking and I look like I look like I'm battling with an invisible fish on a fishing rod. You know, I'm doing all these, I'm moving in every direction, and then it doesn't register. But then the next time I do it, like I barely nudge the thing and the shield rips off and gets, you know, like, so it's not that I thought they were bad ideas. And I specifically love the stuff with the X-ray visor. Like when you get that and you start understanding how those panels work and how the wheels work with the visor on, like, oh, okay, cool. This is just a version of this, but now I can see these runes and pick these things. Like I thought it was a really like an interesting application of that. But the amount of time, especially during, and I'm going to forget her name, but it's the boss fight where she can shapeshift into all the other bosses.
That boss fight. I think that's what took me out of it the first time, I think. Right. I didn't load that save back up, but the timing seems about right.
Gondreda. I don't know how you pronounce it. Yeah.
Gondreda,
Yeah. So that was the one where, like, she changed into whatever boss it was that needed me to rip off, and I was right at the end, but I was like, it was a razor's edge, and that nunchuck was just, and maybe I was failing too much or not enough. I'm sure there was something I was doing wrong, but it would not register that last panel rip off, and I ended up having to redo that whole fight, and I was just like, now, fortunately, this game had checkpoints for things like that, so there are, we've made progress, right? We moved forward a little bit towards player accessibility and stuff, but it still is just one of those moments like, man, if that would have done what it should have done, I would have succeeded. And that's frustrating.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the Japanese version removed a difficulty selection in favor of a Galactic Federation survey that occurred before gameplay, depending on the choices the game sets its difficulty.
That's kind of cool. Yeah. Like your own special test in the vault in Fallout 3.
Yeah, kind of thing, yeah. So just as it's relevant, the original Nintendo blurb for this game says, if you think you knew what it felt like to be the bounty hunter behind the visor, think again. Take aim at evil with Nintendo's revolutionary controller. Players control Samus by moving with the nunchuck and aiming with the pointer, allowing for a level of immersion unlike anything they've ever experienced. Through the eyes of Samus, players experience a quantum leap in first-person control as they wield the Wii Remote, the ultimate device for the first-person shooter genre. Samus will employ well-known power-ups like the Grapple Beam and Morph Ball, as well as a bunch of new surprises to help her survive her coming trials.
You know, it's kind of disappointing with all of the peripherals that the Wii got for everything that it did. There is no arm cannon for the Metroid series.
Yeah, could have been
massive. I would have used it.
Yeah. So I suppose, obviously, we've kind of... It's funny that we're talking about these controls now because some of us already used them on the previous shows for the Metroid Prime games because they put them back in. But yeah, this was the first time that there was no choice. They didn't retrofit GameCube controls into the Wii version, which they could have done, I suppose. But actually, yeah, some of the aspects of this game wouldn't have worked as well, perhaps. But it'll be interesting to see what they do if the Switch version exists for some of the functions that are very specifically around pointing or waggling. Like waggle, there's that word.
The waggle. I wonder if it would just be like a flick the stick left and right or you know, shake the Joy-Con or whatever.
Well, I'm sure there's ways to do it if that's what they want to do. I do agree, for all my problems with the motion controls, I do agree that they add some interesting kind of wrinkles and things that hadn't been done in the other games that really did kind of add something to it. I just didn't like them overall, and specifically in the boss fights, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit, so I'll save.
Yeah, you are definitely not alone in that. And I think, that's probably... Yeah, so I mean, as I say, some people pretty much were down on the entire Wii experience based on the fact that this was a thing. So, completely fair enough. I suppose, outside of that, things like the way that the platforming worked and the scanning worked were much the same as the previous games. What was new to this one was Samus's ship. And the ability to jet from location to location, which I think is cool. And as Brian said, kind of adds to the idea that you're a galaxy hopping badass. On the downside, I do think maybe they took this as an excuse to kind of spread out some of your key power-ups as far apart from one another as possible.
Yeah, there are a few points in the game where they're like, yeah, hey, I know you can't get to where you're going right now. That's probably because the thing you need is on a completely different planet. Go get it. Yeah. Bye.
Yeah. I mean, it does sort of tell you as well, which is, again, so you can turn the hint system off.
Yeah.
But there's still quite a lot of pitching in from voices off.
Yeah, I think they overcorrected on that a little bit.
Right.
But I do like the, if they're going to err on one side or the other, I do like it erring on the side of giving me more information. I do like that. The ship, I don't know. The ship thing was interesting because I remember going into the game, that was the thing that in my mind that I liked the most, that I remember like really bouncing around and like, you know, going like feeling like I was on an investigation and going from place to place and doing these things. And in practice, revisiting it, it was some of that. A lot of times it did feel a little bit of a chore that every time I needed to go to another planet, I had to go back to my ship, get in, hit the button, zoom out to the solar map, go to the place, which landing pad. Like there was like three or four extra steps in there that I wish I didn't have to take, but... it just felt like, as you said, like there'd be sometimes where you just hit a brick wall and be like, I don't know what's going on. And then 30 seconds later, a voice comes in and says, hey, the technology needed to Chozo artifact found on this planet. Go check this out. And then it breadcrumbs you to another place, but it does kind of lead you intentionally to some dead ends and make you return to that ship a little more than probably I'd like it to. Cause it just, you're kind of just waiting for the next thing to tell you, okay, I'm in the wrong spot. Where do I go? You know, like that does kind of become the formula.
Is this the only Metroid game to date that you are able to use your ship as like an actual puzzle solving device?
I think so. I haven't played them all yet. There's still a couple of entries that I'm waiting to play.
Actually played yet is Other M. So we're
doing some. When wildlife controls and pilots your ships and saves you in Metroid Fusion, does that count? when there are deer on board of your
thing,
Metroid
but,
ship, I don't think that counts. But yeah,
but yeah, I mean you do have to use the ship for more than just traveling from place to place, which I think is pretty neat.
Yeah,
me too.
Whole new device.
It's kind of spaced out enough that I almost forget about it every time I go to do one of those puzzles. And then, you know, once you get to the point where like you're trying all your visors just to see what's going on, and that little icon pops up for, yeah, your ship can do something here. And that's kind of neat.
I also liked using it in combat as well. Like there, the areas where you can use it it doesn't happen that often. I don't think that's telegraphed well enough. That's why like every time I'd get an upgrade for my ship missiles, I'd kind of be like, oh yeah, ship missiles. Right. I got to see if I can use those the next time I'm fighting something. Like,
yeah,
I would
do you actually use those? Because I kept picking up the missiles and I didn't really know what to do with them.
So it's any combat arena that's in open air or like in a room that doesn't have a roof that the ship can come around by. But those are pretty few and far between. And even that rule didn't seem to apply to everyone, because there were some that I would be like, oh, I can use my ship missiles. I'd put on that visor and they'd be like, nah, dog, not today. I'm like, damn it. But yeah, it was a cool idea, even though I don't think, as you said, maybe not implemented as often or as effectively enough to make you remember that it's a tool at your disposal.
I'm now temporarily blanking on the Gears of War weapon that you can only fire when you're outdoors.
Oh, Hammer of Dawn.
Hammer of Dawn.
Thank you, folks. Yes. Yeah, it's a bit like that, I guess. So the map is something that, again, has probably brought some criticism from some players in the Metroid Prime games, perhaps in the first couple of games as being a little bit more elaborate and complex than even the fidelity of the graphics could handle, to the point that it's actually kind of difficult to know where you're going and things like that. This is the first Metroid game to allow bookmarks to be set on a map. Did that make all the difference?
I didn't know you could do that. So no, I guess not.
I'm the Metroid Prime map defender of the group. I don't think they're that bad.
I like it too, Brian.
I think that maybe the sectioning off of areas and having you go from planet to planet does make that map system a little better than, say, in Metroid Prime 2, where you're navigating back and forth between like a giant landmass with all these different areas, and then both the light and the dark worlds, and like swiping through there. Like the fact that each of its own area was its own little biome with like kind of a beginning, middle, and end, like an entry point and an exit point, made that map a little less confusing to navigate, like the verticality of it. That's the way I found it anyway. But
I agree. But again, is this a case of, and again, this will depend player to player and mindset to mindset, but is that actually, you know, taking out some of the exploration and the being lost and insignificant in this vast map, and then having to puzzle it out and solve it out and making it a more linear experience, does it take away some of the classic Metroidness?
Maybe. I think that the map stations for these are a little more scarce, at least in my experience. So you still get some of the exploration mechanics that way, because you're not just being shown a complete map and saying, here's the way that you get to the next place. It's not quite the same. And honestly, I really don't mind the map in this game. I think it's okay. Yeah. Much as I thought the map in Metroid Prime 1 was okay. Did not care for the map in 2, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah. More about the design than the actual map itself.
Yeah,
right?
pretty much.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought it was fine, honestly.
In terms of the go on, Brian.
No, I was just going to say that the thing about this map does, and you pointed out, Leon, and I didn't realize it until you just said this, was that I really didn't do as much backtracking in this, and it probably is because of the sectioned off nature of the map. And only because in those other games I would like be like, I don't know where to go right now, but I did just get the beam that opens up orange doors, so let me just pull up the map and see where the orange... But if I'm on a planet already and there's not... There might be one door here or there, but it's not like... You're not looking at that grand map. So I never thought about that. That probably... Because instinctively, I just didn't do as much like scouring. A lot of it was on the main path already, but I would go into every door or whatever room that I could and check it all out. But I never felt that draw to like really go back. So that's interesting. Yeah,
it's kind of an accessibility thing again. Maybe the fact that this game was on this new and way more successful console. I remember when years ago we talked about Super Mario Galaxy 2. There were. Even though they'd already released the first Galaxy on the Wii as well, with 2, it was during that period where Nintendo were trying to add a lot of accessibility stuff to games, you know, super guides and helpers and power-ups for failing and all that kind of stuff. And some of that's remained right up until till the present day. But maybe the philosophy about Metroid Prime 3 Corruption, they knew a lot of new people would be coming to, maybe the sales... belie that, but they were hoping that a lot of new people would come to this series, because simply because the Wii was selling many times more units than the, although I suppose actually at the time they were developing this, they didn't know that was going to happen. But yeah, were they just looking to make a game in which, yeah, a more quote casual audience didn't spend so much time getting lost and frustrated? I suppose, yeah, that brings us to the question in terms of the pacing, the progression, the items, the upgrades, that wonderful, you know, the endorphin drip and the neurotransmitters being sparked by the thought of being able to go back to somewhere we'd seen earlier and open up, or the feeling of solving a particularly difficult room and getting hold of the power up. Were we getting the dopamine hits that we expect from a Metroid experience in Prime 3, or was it diluted by the relative linearity and the self-contained aspects of the map, Leah?
I think it's probably diluted a little bit. I didn't hate the pacing in this. I thought that it was pretty decent. And like I said, I do like that they didn't start you out from complete rock bottom Samus has nothing.
Yeah.
So that was helpful for me. But yeah, I mean, given that the maps were broken up as they were, I guess it's kind of up to your play style as to whether you're going to say, okay, well, now I can open up the plasma beam doors, so I'm going to go back to this place that I went before and check out all the plasma beam doors before I do anything else. That's not probably how I'm going to play if it's in different maps like that, but I know that a lot of people will. So I feel like this is probably a pretty like your mileage will vary type of game for that.
How's your mileage, Brian?
Yeah, it's interesting because I would have told you that the process for getting the screw attack jump in Metroid Prime 2 was way too overwrought, took way too many puzzles, took too long to get, two other things. And then in this game, it was just kind of, hey, I see the tank with the screw attack, there it is. And then you killed like six or seven enemies and then poof, there it was and you had it. So like, there's probably a balance to be struck. And I do think this game probably falls on the side of not making the player do a whole heck of a lot to get those upgrades. Maybe that is the Wii thing again. Maybe it's the design philosophy of this one. But I didn't get the... There was no power-up that I was just waiting to get. There was some areas, especially in Metroid Prime, the original, where like you know that a double jump is going to get you to that ledge. And you walk by that ledge 100 times back and forth, and you're just like, I just want to get up there. I don't care what's up there. It could be just more enemies and nothing. I just need to see what's up there. And then eventually you get it, right? There wasn't that feeling in this game. There was like, I never got an item. It was like, oh, great, now I can do X. So maybe it did kill some of that dopamine for me, because I was looking for it, and not to jump forward to summaries or anything like that. It's just like I've been struggling, and I wrote it down here in my notes. This game is missing something for me, but I can't tell you what it is, you know. And maybe that's it right there. Maybe it's just like those dopamine hits, that feeling of exploration, that feeling of discovery that comes from other games in the series that I find so satisfying. Maybe that just wasn't hitting on whatever level it normally does for me. Maybe that's the thing that's missing.
The push and pull of the endless push and pull of how much resistance we want versus how much satisfaction we get in ultimately getting past that resistance. Yeah. This is why, because it absolutely isn't an exact science. There is no, as far as I'm concerned, because as I say, it might even be different for different people on different days or different games, you know. So the idea to me that there's the perfect solution to this is simply it's not possible. And it only ever comes down to how we feel about that particular game at that particular time. And there were probably, you know, a lot of very specific and granular decisions made by the development team about what they wanted to do in terms of rewarding the player. And yeah, I think after you've made two games in a series already, I think it becomes both easier and harder to make a third one, doesn't it? Because you've got a lot of feedback, but you've also got a lot of feedback. Weapons wise, I think it's fair to say that although we consider these games perhaps mostly as arcade adventures with traversal and puzzling as a huge part of them, you probably still spend more time shooting than you do doing any other individual action. I think that's true of probably most of the Metroid games that I've played anyway, even the ones that are, you know, very heavily about platforming and puzzle solving. You still just shoot the whole time. It's like it's absolutely part of the experience. And yeah, for me, like, this is where there's a lot to like about the shooting in the Metroid Prime trilogy, but also there's some aspects that for me they never quite nailed the satisfaction of blasting things. That's an area that maybe they could have taken a bit more if they'd had the processing power and the development skills to make the Metroid games that much more incredible would have been to bring in some of the physics and interaction between the enemies and the world and the player and all that kind of thing, because to me it always still feels a little bit hands off in some ways. We've got James from Patreon who says, Metroid Prime 3 was an ambitious attempt to bring the series more mainstream attention. The voice acting, more story-focused plot and simplification of the beams, stacking as opposed to choosing yourself, made for an engaging title that I enjoyed at the time. Unfortunately, the shoehorned in motion controls and smaller, less connected locations have become more apparent since playing the remaster of the original Metroid Prime. Mark, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I agree that the beam thing, just making them upgrades as opposed to making them additional choices. I liked that aspect because it meant that you didn't have to switch between things in order to get through different combat encounters. Yeah. The problem that I found there was that it meant all the beams kind of felt the same. It didn't have much of a difference to me. I mean, you do still get the hyper mode beam, which is a little bit different, but like your plasma beam to your Nova beam, there just isn't a whole lot there to me.
Yeah, so I think it does a lot of things right in the sense that it got rid of, like, the beam ammo things from Metroid Prime 2.
Yeah.
Like, there's certain things that, like, make it a little bit more of a friendly experience, but I agree. There's nothing that feels substantial. And frankly, I don't know how you guys felt about this towards the end, but there wasn't a, like, if I would just come across a couple space pirates in a room or a couple of those, you know, like, crab-ish creatures, spidery creatures on the ground, I'd just blast them away or use a missile maybe or whatever. Mm-hmm. But any major boss or major series of enemies before, like, it was absolutely inject an energy tank into my veins, get to the Gatling, you know, charge beam. And that was, like, pretty much my solution for every combat puzzle after that.
And I think they're expecting you to do that most of the time.
Yeah. And it feels really good, but I just did it so much by the end that, like it became that weird economy of, like, do I have enough energy tanks to do hyper mode two more times? Should I wait and look around, see if I can get more? And it was definitely more of a resource management thing from a life perspective than it was ammo. So I guess kind of substituting one with the other. But once that started really hitting, like, I didn't rely on much else wait until the boss was vulnerable, switch into hyper mode, and then blast away. And some of those bosses you can take down in relatively short order by doing that. It's just a matter of waiting for your opening.
Yeah, so anecdotally, I hear that Retro didn't want hyper mode. It was Nintendo's internal suggestion, resisted by Retro, but ultimately they capitulated and included it in apparently in a slightly less usable and powerful form than Nintendo had originally wanted. So they wanted something that was kind of all powerful, I guess, whereas Retro at least kind of made it so that you couldn't just spam it, basically.
The best part about hyper mode is you get that great cutscene at the end of every seed where the little corruption cell in Metroid's brain, like, squiggles out and she goes, like, super
press
hyper.
Press A to direct your energy or whatever.
Yes exactly. Yeah. Press A, to unload Phazon energy, whatever it is, like, this giant splash screen. Like, I do love that every time, like, Samus, defeats the seed boss or whatever, and then just get molecular, go right into her brain and watch this little black, almost like venom symbiote thing kind of spread its tentacles. I did enjoy those moments. It made me laugh. By the last one, I was laughing out loud. I thought it was pretty great.
Mark Pacini speaking to IGN back just before the game, or a few months before the game came out, in an interview said, "For Metroid Prime 3, we're kind of going with a different beam structure than previous Prime games. One of the main mechanics of the previous games was switching to the correct beam to deal with a given situation. In Corruption, we did a little homage to Super Metroid by implementing stacking systems so that each beam weapon you get will stack upon the previous. You'll start out with the power beam, and then you'll get the plasma beam, and on top of that you'll get another beam. They will all inherit the abilities of the previous beam, but you won't have to switch between them. And the missile does the same thing. As well, the grapple beam has become a much more important part of the gameplay system because now you can manipulate and grapple things, and the grapple beam also stacks with abilities. So instead of it mainly being a game where you switch beams, it's more a game about going between beam, missile, and grapple as your main trinity of weapons that you use to deal with certain situations."
This is probably a me problem, but I did find it annoying that when you get the super missile, the lock-on super missile, mm-hmm. You have to waste a missile to hold down the button.
To activate it, yeah.
I did not like that. Now, I had like 220, 230 missiles by the end, so like it was not a problem really, but I don't like wasting missiles.
Yeah, that definitely was a thing. Every single time I would laugh at that, one missile goes just flying into the ether and then you start charging it up. The grapple, I forget about the grapple just because I think I want to forget about the grapple, if I'm being honest. But the thing that is interesting about that is that grapple is used to solve an overwhelming majority of the puzzles, not just in combat, but in traversal too. Like you'll just see, there'll just be a panel on the wall and once you saw the little target reticles around it, even though you haven't scanned it yet, I was like, "Bet you I can grapple that." And if you fished your left hand forward, if you're playing, right-handed with the remote, almost I would say 9 times out of 10 that grapple would shoot out and you could yank that thing off. So that was used pretty often. And then I want to say, I mean, almost every boss encounter after you had the grapple had some verse you had to use the grapple at some point during the boss encounter, almost all of them. So it definitely became, I never thought of it as like the trinity as the IGN correspondent said, but that definitely does feel that way now that I think about it.
Yeah, it's funny that I would say motion controls now are used generally so sparingly in games that I even have to kind of think about which consoles have them. So like, yeah, PlayStation still has motion controls, right? If it wants them in certain games, it knows whether it has the tech in the DualSense, doesn't it, to know how you're holding the controller. I know that because I played Astro's Playroom, right? That demonstrates all that stuff. Xbox doesn't have motion controls at all, but actually 99% of the time I'm barely aware that the PlayStation is using motion controls. There's so little kind of mandatory waggle in games these days. But here we are from talking 2007, a game that was developed starting 2004 and was originally set to release in 2006. Perhaps it was just that phase. Will we go through another round of motion controls being all the rage? Or 3D TVs?
If we don't do that.
Yeah. Or Kinects, all that. We could go through another.
How long before all of our handheld PCs have, HD rumble and gyro control?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, it does.
Steam Deck, does that have motion controls? I genuinely don't know.
I don't think so. It has rumble.
Yeah.
Okay. And it gives off a nice smell out the vents, I understand, as well.
You're not supposed to sniff the vents.
I haven't got one.
Have you sniffed the vents of your Steam Deck?
It does smell pretty good.
Yeah, it's impossible. Once somebody says don't sniff the vents, it's like, yeah, okay, well, now I have to sniff the vents.
Exactly.
Like,
don't lick the Switch cartridges. Ooh, yeah, okay. So exactly. Sounds like somebody
still hasn't done that.
You're also not supposed to put your tongue on 9-volt batteries, but don't tell my elementary school self.
Yeah.
I'm doing it all the time.
Listen, some people just want to take the fun out of everything.
Yeah, it's like it's the red big red button that says do not press. I don't know about whether the Asus ROG Ally, like our friend Tony's got, Don't know whether that has rumble, motion controls, lickable screens.
Well, mine arrived yesterday, so I'll let you know.
Oh,
very nice.
It was stuck in California for 2 weeks. I had to call FedEx. It sucked, but it's here
okay.
now.
Well, sniff the vents and let us know
I
how
will.
You get
yes.
on. If you
this
live.
Is important research.
Yeah, it's true.
Okay, after that little sidestep. bosses. So there are, what, about 14 bosses, I think, in this one? Something like that.
Depends on what you count, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I so this is, I said I had two big problems with this game.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
This is the second one. Okay. The bosses.
All the bosses. Or some yeah. of the bosses. All
I
the
mean,
bosses.
I mean, just the bosses as a group. There are probably some that, actually, I know for a fact that there's one that got me worse than the others, but, and it's the guy with the orbs. My God, that, and when I say the guy with the orbs, I mean the guy that has the, like, red orbs in him, and if you destroy those orbs, you have to, like, burn out the sockets so that he can't use them
yeah.
anymore.
Yeah.
But he will continue, if you don't do that, to just replace the orbs in himself, and the last orb is on his back, and it's really hard to get behind him to shoot the orb that's on his back, so I spent a long time in that boss fight. I'm not bitter. But, so, I think that the bosses were a pretty, for me at least, and I'll be interested to hear what you guys have to say, but they were a pretty steep difficulty hike, just compared to kind of the rest of the game. Mm. And I had the most problem, this intersects with my other problem, the controls, because
yeah.
if I was doing just exploration or kind of the main progression through the storyline, then if something didn't immediately make sense in the controls, I could pause for a second and kind of sort it out myself. If that happens during a boss fight, you don't really have that time. So I spent a lot of time. I think one of the main things that makes me dislike the controls is that your looking and your aiming are kind of the same motion. So I would end up yeah. looking in one direction and thinking that I was aiming at the correct part of the boss, but I wasn't because I was looking in some other direction.
Right.
I just, the controls, my issues with the controls really hampered my performance on the bosses. And since the bosses were more difficult, in my opinion, that didn't help. Yeah.
Ryan. Yeah. I think I agree with you mostly, Leah. We've talked about this a little bit, in passing and in our messaging. I think, the boss I can use my best example, this is Gore. He's the one that slides around in his little ice, you know, surfboard,
yeah.
silver surfer style. And, he, you know, so I'd be doing some decent damage to him or I'd be, you know, getting through his phases and then he'd get on that ice, you know, surfboard and just fly around. And I'd
yep.
spend a majority of the fight looking up and to the left and turning in circles slowly, you know, because I'm not using stick controls. I'm using the Wiimote controls, turning slowly, trying to fight him. Then he'd zip by and I kind of turn around. That if you were to get a third person view of my Samus during that fight, Samus would just be pointing her air into the sky and looking up and just spinning in circles. You know what
yep.
I mean? Like looking for Gore. And I think that some of these bosses move very fast and they have a lot of animations, a lot of phases, and a lot of ways to damage you. Now, what I think this game does well is that it doesn't, there's no attacks by these bosses that are particularly like high damage until the end of the game. So I think it gives you good leeway to learn the phases, at least for me it did. But it didn't change the fact that some of these phases, that if you aren't in what, in my opinion, I'm sure it's, there are people who I'm sure are snipers at this game, but for me, I couldn't get some of those pinpoint precisions on all the points I needed to hit in that scan of time that I'd find myself in a situation where I would know defense drone is what I'm thinking of. That's a good example of this. I knew exactly how to defeat that thing. I knew the phases, I knew what I had to do, but it took me like 5 or 6 cycles to actually accomplish that thing. And I found that to be a point of frustration, which really sucks. Because this game went right after the criticisms of Metroid Prime 2 with one of the first bosses it throws right at you, Mecha Ridley. Like, people were complaining in Metroid Prime 2 that there's none of the bosses, none of the things, for, except save for Dark Samus, there was no Metroid history in there. And this game's like, you want Metroid history? Here's Ridley right off the bat. Like, it's just such a cool way to start, right? You see a character
and
that
Ridley
you know...
really doesn't have any reason to be in this game.
No, not at all. But, like, it's just like, hey, you guys want something for Metroid history? Just bam, here you go.
Hate Samus.
And then you get to fight Omega Ridley again. Like, those fights are I'm willing to overlook some of the frustrations of those fights because I'm engaging with this villain that I've known now throughout how many games, right? It's cool. It's a fun little thing to see. But in some of these other battles, I think Gandraya, I hope I'm saying that right. Gandraya. I keep saying that, yeah. The Metroid Hatcher is maybe the one exception to this for me, which I found this completely on accident. I looked it up. If you have the X-ray visor for the Metroid Hatcher, you can see its heart inside of it, and you can zoom in, and you can one-shot kill it.
Aww.
So I did that cool. on accident. I was like, that was incredible. I was like very excited. Like sorry.
You fight that stupid thing three times.
Yes.
Like, please no.
So I find the bosses, I think I'm a bit tired of the bosses in the Metroid Prime games. Like, sure. And again, I acknowledge that we played these closer together than they were originally released, and that can make a difference. But I think they sometimes kind of just emphasize the things about the shooting and the combat, which I don't like. There are, as I say, there are aspects that I do like. I like the sidestep feels quite cool, and the pointy aiming I'm generally okay with. Although, yeah, there are frustrations with, pointing off the bit of the screen that actually registers and all that other stuff. But yeah, they end up just feeling a bit attritional to me. And in this one, because the game I think is a bit more generous with health. So generally by the time you come to the boss, as Brian says, they don't tend to do too many mega damaging hits. I measure them always against the one boss that really, really gave me pain the first time I played Metroid Prime, which was Ridley before the final boss. And that one just really stressed me out, and I was really concerned that I was never going to get past it and not see the end of this game that I'd absolutely adored up to that point. But eventually I did. I can't remember how many tries it took me. I think, I probably, with hindsight, probably could have gone back and found some more health or something. Maybe there was a reason I couldn't. I don't know. So every boss fight after that has been measured up against the pain, the difficulty that I found with that one. And as such, this game actually feels to me like it has the easiest bosses, in the sense that they weren't likely to, just finish me off and put me in a corner. But that's not to say I don't disagree with Leah either. They are kind of difficult, spiky. I think perhaps that's by design. But yes, they've made it so that you can have these rather long, drawn out attritional fights where you keep, taking hits and then sucking up as much health back as you can and eventually prevailing. But yes, it's not the part of the game that I really look forward to. And again, I think this is where having made a trilogy in relatively short order can be difficult, because some of the ideas had been, a lot of the cool ideas they'd already used, which means a certain amount of recycling or trying things out, which perhaps, are untried and less fun. So yeah, I mean, not certainly not ruinous for me. And I still think for me, this is the most easily completed of the three games. But yeah, nothing that memorable either. I wish that I didn't know about the one shot kill there on the Metroid Hatcher. That's probably the most interesting thing I've heard about the bosses.
I think that the final boss rush is kind of interesting just because of the different angle it takes. Now, I don't know. I assume that the amount of kind of leeway that you have there is still linked to how many health tanks you got during the game. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I died the first time because I was not expecting there to be a third boss after the second boss, and I ran out of meter and died. Yeah,
it does. It does. It is based on how many energy tanks you got.
So I just kind of assumed that it had to be, because otherwise, what would be the point? But I actually went back
to get a couple because I was like my bar was like 60% full, and I got a little farther away. I'm like, I might just go back, and I guided up and got a couple more and went back, and
Wu King Long from our forum says, I was one energy cell short of finishing the game on my first playthrough, and I didn't have the patience to search it out back then. Now, 17 years later, it is the final Prime title, which I finally completed. The irony that this is the entry of the Prime trilogy to have the least MacGuffin hunting required is not lost on me in hindsight. I'll be honest, I don't feel I missed much by not tackling the final boss back then. All of your health upgrades were rendered moot by having the hyper mode bar replace them, and the fight itself is the easiest in the trilogy by a wide margin. This led to a very anticlimactic final battle for the big bad of the entire trilogy and the source of all Phazon. I'm getting ahead of myself, though. This is my favourite entry in the Prime trilogy, despite its flaws, mainly for its brevity, but I can see why fans of the earlier entries might view it as a lesser experience. Exploration is severely scaled back, with areas being relatively more linear and the hint on where to go popping up much quicker than in the previous games. As a fan of more linear search action games, this is a benefit in my book, as I spend less time trudging slowly through 3D environments and can be confident I'm heading in the right general direction. Combat is also made extra perfunctory with hyper mode. This is fine by me, as in the Prime trilogy, fighting enemies usually felt like a punishment or drain on resources rather than the main attraction. The motion control gimmick emphasis is novel at times and inoffensive for the most part, thanks to minimal waggling. The sound design, music and atmosphere were top-notch as usual, and are what makes the game worth experiencing, in my opinion. Bosses remain a low point, although they are the best the trilogy manages here, final boss excluded. Looking back at the entire Metroid Prime trilogy after playing it over the past year, I can now confidently be certain that 3D search action titles are just not really a presentation of the IP that I click with. I much prefer them in their original 2D form, with easier navigation, movement that doesn't feel so plodding, and combat I feel is much more enjoyable. I'm glad to have experienced them, but that's enough for me. The Metroid title with Prime in the name that I've enjoyed the most remains Hunters.
I agree with most of what Wu King Long said there, except for the bosses part. I don't think they were the best in this trilogy. I think the Metroid Prime 2 bosses are bangers. I mean, even the ones that I couldn't stand, like the spider ball morph ball fight, and then there's the one where you have to boost ball up onto the back of the creature and spider ball around and bomb them. They're at least attempting something different there. When I feel like not every boss fight, that'd be a little too generic, but most of the boss fights here are very similar in the sense of you have a humanoid-esque creature, especially the bounty hunters and Dark Samus, right? Or you have a big Metroid-ish floating creature. You get through the three or four levels of them trying to deal you damage. Then they expose to you the way you can do damage to them, and then you repeat it. And there wasn't one that I felt like took advantage of a gimmick in a way. Now, gimmicky fights are a razor's edge, right? They can be great or they can be terrible. But at least I feel like those I can give credit for attempting something unique. Well, these all kind of felt like reskinned versions of the same fight over and over and over again. And to the point where, and I agree with them, the final boss fight for me was the easiest one, in the sense it was a little long because you had those three phases. But by the time that floating head is there, like, it's just a matter of, do I have the energy to get through this or not? Because I know where to hit it. I know what to do. It's just a matter of getting to the point where you can actually do it.
So three endings to go for. I've definitely only seen the basic one, which is up to 75% items collected, which is quite, there's still a fair amount of effort, I would say, to see that upon escaping back through the wormhole along with the fleet, Samus farewells Admiral Dane before heading for parts unknown. Sure. We know what happens because this is set before Metroid 2, I think. So I think that's what happens next. I forget the order. I haven't got it written in front of me. Did anyone manage to get the 75 to 99% ending?
I did.
Oh, nice one.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. From what I understand, both the endings are. I did not actually see the second bonus ending. But she's just kind of sitting around in Skytown thinking about her friends. Oh. you get a little greatest hits scenes of the game, which is mostly battles. It's a little odd actually that she's thinking about how she killed her fellow bounty hunters, but yeah. That's
it's not like a PTSD thing.
I don't think so.
Is Baka Mitai playing in the background?
I wish. Yeah. Oh, my God.
That's a Yakuza reference. I apologize, everybody. I can imagine Kiryu reminiscing about Akiyama. Nani, nani. Oh, but anyway, sorry.
Is she naked? Or
no. Helmetless, but not...
not in a bikini.
No, yeah, no bikini Samus this time.
So that's 100%, right?
The 100% is her naked? I don't know. I didn't get 100%. I got 90 something.
100%. Well, that's pretty good going. If you get 100%, after the credits roll, Samus returns to her ship while removing the Varia suit, revealing her favorite blue Zero Mission undersuit. As Samus leaves Alicia's orbit and heads for the stars, you'll see something rather interesting. Dot, dot, dot.
I believe that there's a ship following her is the extra thing.
Does it hint at
something interesting?
Yeah, what happened next?
Anyway. I think that that's the intent, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, we didn't talk about this much in visuals. I meant to bring it up. She takes out the Varia suit, which I think is funny because you don't really see the suits except for riding elevators and getting out of the ship. It's not really a big part of what you're looking at the entire game. But what I will say is that the way that the Varia suit evolves with the corruption in this one, like where to wear her like shoulder pauldrons, like end up with a kind of those like glowing pentagons on there that are like radiating blue energy. I thought Samus by the end of this game looked pretty cool. Approaching Dark Samus levels of color, you know what I mean? Like real, a lot of emanating blues and things like that. I thought it was a neat and unique look. I forgot that that's how she looked by the end of the game.
Her eyes go more and more Faison-y.
Yes.
As well. Yeah. So as we said, the How Long to Beat site gives this completion time of 13 and a half hours or 15 if you do a bit more, or 17 and a half if you do everything. I don't know exactly how accurate that is, but it gives you a general guide. However, if you want to get good, you can complete this game apparently in 2 hours and 30 minutes and 18 seconds. Well, somebody from Argentina did, Mr. Miguel, back in 2022, has the world record. So,
I wonder what, like, it would seem hard to sequence break in this game where you are gated by, like, going to different planets. Like, I wonder how they accomplished that. I might look into that. That seems like it could be fun.
It depends on whether it's like a glitched thing or not, because if they can, depending on how the assets are stored in the game, they might be able to like clip out of a world and like across a void to another world. Like, I mean, there is obviously the intent to make it seem like these are far away, but I in game terms, they probably are not. They're probably just like next to each other.
Also, interestingly, speedrun.com lists separate times for time and in-game time. So this might tie in with what you discovered, Brian, in terms of in-game time for that 2:13 world record, it was 1:41.
Interesting.
So percentage wise, that's probably not dissimilar.
Yeah. Strange. I wonder what I'd love to know where
it's gotta be like the, I don't know. I would think it, maybe it's both. Maybe it's the in-game movies and it's the map.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Various things. And also I noticed on speedrun.com, the 10th time, it looks like not that many people submit to this because the 10th time is 11 hours and 22 minutes in-game time. So, nice. So if
you
want to get in the record
books, your time, yeah.
Yeah. This is what happened with our friend Ben with Metroid 1, which is he went from not having played the game, and then like 6 weeks later, he was like the fourth fastest in the world at it. But that's Ben for you.
Yeah.
Sean S. Thomas from our forum says, Corruption is probably the most linear game in the Prime series. It throws an ensemble cast around Samus Aran that breaks the solitary atmosphere. And while I'm a huge fan of them normally, the motion controls here add little. But equally, I feel like there are some moments in it that hint at how Metroid Prime 4 might evolve the series, if it ever releases. Firstly, when I picture it, the game feels wonderfully colourful and joyful. The sequences in the sky in particular stick in the mind. After the grim environments and challenge of echoes, that's highly welcome. Secondly, the choice of being able to tackle the various worlds in any order did make you feel like a real adventurer travelling the galaxy. Getting to return there with new abilities late game was also rewarding. Lastly, I loved the relationship Samus had with her gunship. The way you use it as a companion to clear debris, lift objects, and guide your path forward was really clever. It gave the ship a real sense of importance, and it's the one idea from Corruption that Retro Studios should retain and develop. I probably prefer Corruption to Echoes personally because it's just less crushingly oppressive to play. I played all three Prime games back-to-back when they released as a trilogy, and I was still enjoying the formula after 100 plus hours. But it's hard to argue that the series wasn't slightly diminishing returns after the original. I really hope 4 can recapture that sense of isolation and alien wonder from the trilogy. We shall see. It's not Retro now, right? It's a Nintendo studio.
Didn't Retro retake it over?
Oh. Did they? I've lost track, to be perfectly honest.
If I remember correctly, it's an upcoming. Yeah, it's being developed by Retro and published by.
Okay, like, cool.
So it was Troubled Development. Nintendo scrapped it and brought in Retro to then do it. And I thought, because Retro was supposedly working on that rumored Star Fox Mario Kart-like game for a long time. That might still come out. I have no idea what's going on over there. Just let me into R&D and just let me look around for a minute. I promise I won't post any pictures on the internet. I just want to know what's happening in there.
I'm sure we're all looking forward to it anyway. Could be a Switch 2 launch title.
Could
be. Sort of testament to folks not really remembering this game. We've only had one 3-word review. Brian.
Bearfish Pie says Samus's goth phase, but spelled P-H-A-Z-E, like phase. You guys get it?
Yeah.
I feel like Bearfish Pie submitted that for Echoes as well.
I mean,
that would be awesome.
Also true.
Yeah.
So there we go. That's odd. I mean, it's a million seller. We got one response. What can I say? I don't know what to say. Let's round off then with our summaries, concluding the Metroid Prime trilogy with Leah.
So I know I've had a lot of kind of critical things to say about this game, but I really did like it. In fact, I think that if I could play it with a non-Wiimote controller, I would probably really like it. I liked the exploration. I thought that for the most part, the environments were nice to explore. Brian and I have both mentioned the Alesia world as kind of being a standout, and I think that really does hold true. It's a different approach than having everything kind of combined on the same planet, but I don't think that I have a preference there. I think that they both have their own kind of charm when you're picking up a game like this. So, I would recommend playing this game, but I feel like you might want to, if you're not like raring to go right away, maybe wait and see if they do put out a remaster, because I think that would actually probably fix a lot of the issues that I have with this game. But some of those are already kind of ameliorated by things like the autosaves and the fact that the overall difficulty is fairly low in comparison to the other games in the series. So I do still recommend it with a few reservations and just kind of know what you're getting into. And maybe don't play in long spurts unless your wrists are stronger than mine.
Thanks, Leah. Yeah, mixed feelings on this one for me. Definitely not strongly negative ones, but also I feel like the game gives and takes away in some areas. It in the way that they address some of the issues we've had with previous games, or I've had with previous games, about not being told where to go, or tedious MacGuffin fetch quests, or various kind of, well, listen back to those shows. I won't go through it all again, but there are certain aspects to the Prime games that were slightly short of where they wanted them to be, even though I absolutely loved the original Prime, and still do. And I'm really happy that that's the one that has at least got a remaster that we can play right now and is widely available on current gen system and affordable and all that stuff. And I think they did a really good job. Just even the act of if your Wii or Wii U isn't kind of ready to go, even the act of getting back into playing games 2 and 3 is like an effort in itself, and then playing them with the Wiimote and nunchuck is sometimes just slightly more of an effort than you want to make for what is nearly a 20-year-old game. I think this, in some ways it's the smoothest ride, but I think that is almost to a fault. And we never get any closer to answering the question as kind of what is the right balance of handholding and guidance. And I think, some games definitely have done it very well, but there's always, I feel like, I don't know, maybe it's my aging memory, but I find it increasingly difficult to kind of have those moments that I do remember from playing these kinds of games when I was younger, where you do have I remember seeing that door or gap like 25 hours ago. I just don't think those little moments kind of make memories in the same way once you get to the sort of age that I am. And it's there, especially, split up with real life and other games and all that kind of thing. It's just not realistic to think that I'm going to be able to navigate my way back to something that was indicated to me obliquely 25 game hours ago or whatever. So I'm thankful for the help in some ways, but also it does take away some of the sense of exploration and actual personal achievement of navigating your way through a game like this. The combat is no more fun than it was in the previous games, really. Although they've softened off some of the rough edges with the stacking beams and the hyper mode and all that kind of thing. So it's a solid end to the trilogy. In some ways, I think it's an easier play than 2 Echoes, but in other ways, I think it's less rewarding to actually battle your way through it. Prime 1 remains my favorite of the trilogy, but overall, I still think it's a great set of games. And yes, I think they should absolutely release 2 and 3 as remasters, whether it be on Switch 1 or 2, so we can all enjoy them easily again. Brian.
Yeah, hard to follow either of that, because I agree with both of you on every point. No, not at all. The cool thing that I get to do now and in finishing this summary is I get to think about like the future, right? So you guys have said everything I feel about this game. We've talked about it, and we've talked about all of these Prime games. And I think, as you see, if you listen to all 3 episodes back to back, which I command that you do right now, you'd see that like all of the ideas, and there's a continuity through all 3 of these games of combat ideas and design ethos and things that maybe by the end of Metroid Prime 3, that as they were attempting to refine and make more user-friendly, make more accessible, maybe in doing that they sanded off some of the personality edges too, and maybe created something that felt a little bland or overdone or maybe reworked and not original in the way that the first game felt and still feels when you go back to it. So, but what they did do is they tried developing the game for a new control scheme. They tried implementing some ship things, tried to vary the locations based on some different ideas about how the player would maybe interact with the game. And I think you see all this in this game, and they've reworked both the original, the second one, and this one was originally designed for Wii controls. And then now you see the remaster of Metroid Prime come out, and that's so well received, and that's the dual stick Switch control. I mean, Leah and Leon, you have both played that remaster. Mm-hmm. I've yet to play it. It's on my Switch. I'm going to make some time for it later this year. And it just, like, it seems like the energy and like the appetite for that type of experience is pretty high. So if you were to look to see where they kind of went from 1, 2, and 3, and then the potential of 4 in the future, is that if they are now getting back to some of the same design ethos, but they are using dual stick controls, they've taken out the motion stick controls, they're moving forward, and they're taking all the lessons that they've learned from 1, 2, and 3, and then applying it however many years later now, 17 years later, if mm-hmm. it comes out this year, to Metroid Prime 4, I think there's a recipe for an all-timer there. And playing through Metroid Prime 3, all of those disappointments and everything, like Leah said, that we've talked about, it didn't change the fact that when I was in the moment getting upgrades and going through and screw attacking over long gaps and then grappling down these long, elaborate, like, rails and doing all of the Metroid things, it was still really fun. Like, the 16 hours I spent with this game melted away. Like, this game never felt like a chore to play, so if you have an opportunity to sit down with it and you've never played it before, it's not like you're gonna sit down and be like, oh, this is a home. Like, it's still a really good one of these. It just maybe doesn't do enough to separate it from the other two. And I think that part of that's some unique bosses, part of that's some unique abilities. The way that in Metroid Prime 2, the dark beam and the dark world separated itself. There's nothing in this game that really separated itself except for hyper mode, which was such a specific use case type thing. So maybe it just didn't do enough to separate itself, but going back to it, yeah, there was a reason I forgot all the stuff from it, but it also, like, it, when I got done playing it, I still thought it was time well spent. So yeah, you could do much worse than playing Metroid Prime 3 in 2024, and it might just do enough to whet the appetite before Metroid Prime 4 comes out in 17 years. So
unless it makes you really sick, like yeah, it or did that. Dan. In which
just
case,
weak.
Put it down. Yeah, puny weeds. Thanks, Brian. Very well said. So that's that trilogy concluded. The Metroid series continued on the Wii, and I've still never played that game. And in fact, I still don't even own a copy, so I should probably sort that out before we play that later this year, Other M. For now, it just remains for me, Leon, to thank Brian and Leah, and Dan for his doomed efforts, Editor Jay, as well as our correspondents, and of course, everyone for listening. Next time, in issue 606, in Castlevania 10, we dance to the Rondo of Blood.